was a warm and good friend to them, and they continue to express appreciation for that. Professor Koenig was a visiting scholar from 1987 to 1988. He received his bachelor's degree at American University and his master's from the University of Western Australia. He earned a PhD from Cambridge University in England. At the University of Western Illinois, he's held a whole series of positions and has proved himself the kind of faculty member that every university hopes for, but very few actually discover. President of, he's almost another Arthur Stocker, president of the personnel of the honors program, the personnel committee, the faculty senate, and a great many other things. He's written widely on both World War I and World War II, most notably a book entitled Distractions of Peace During War, The Lord George Government's Reaction to Woodrow Wilson, December 1916 to November 1918. He's written articles on a wide range of subjects, from Henry Jackson Turner's frontier theory, to Henry Kissinger, to the relation of Australia and America, Wilson's self-determination, historical reflections to the danger ahead, and a significant article bearing on our topic today in 1985 in the Political Science Quarterly, a leading political science journal, entitled How Realistic is Reagan's Diplomacy? He's also written texts on world history, the study of civilization, and other subjects. We, throughout 1989-90, will be concentrating on the Reagan presidency, and a wide range of people, Paul Nitze, Richard Perle, Lynn Nofziger, Fred Fielding, quite a collection of people who were at the center of the Reagan administration, both as political people and as administrators, will be coming to the center. But the debate about the Reagan presidency has already begun, as is true with every presidency. A very interesting aspect of it is the debate between Fred Greenstein, who at the Miller Center completed the writing of the first major revisionist work on Eisenhower, entitled The Hidden Hand Presidency, who says that Reagan never did delegate effectively and didn't do the kind of thing that Greenstein found that Eisenhower had done, although the public didn't know it at the time. On the other hand, Lou Cannon, the official Reagan columnist writing in the Washington Post, has begun to ask, will we, when we look carefully at the Reagan presidency, find that President Reagan, like President Eisenhower, was much more on top of the details of policy than had been expected at the time? And that's only one of the issues that is going to be explored and discussed in the coming months and years. So we are pleased, in addition to the insiders, to have a few outsiders who will talk about the Reagan presidency. And since from the very first years of the Reagan presidency, Professor Koenig had been writing on the Reagan foreign policy, and since he also was an alumni of the center, we thought it was very fitting that he talk with us for a while about the Reagan presidency and foreign policy. We're delighted to have you back.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to be back. Actually, I came here from Illinois. It's wonderful to see some rain again, although it's nice and sunny today. It's almost a homecoming for me, and I really appreciate that all of you came out, and it's very nice to see familiar faces. You're obviously correct that people are lining up on the assessment of the Reagan presidency. I was looking at some things yesterday, and the contrast is just amazing. This is a piece from that was in the VQR, and you get some sense of the... it's a piece by James Nathan, sense of the piece by the title, Decisions in the Land of Pretend, U.S. Foreign Policy in the Reagan Years, kinds of describes Reagan's policy in terms of a Max Senate comedy and chaos and being asleep at the switch quotes Haig's picture of the administration as kind of a ghost ship where you get glimpses of the crew, but you don't know who's really guiding the thing. On the other hand, a very interesting piece by a professor out at Berkeley, Aaron Woldofsky, who says nothing less than Reagan remains the most creative president of recent times, and with Franklin Roosevelt, one of the two most influential of the modern era. It's hard to imagine a greater contrast than that by serious scholars. Well, I've really enjoyed following this presidency in the last 8 years, and just simply because Reagan was president of the United States, we must take him seriously. And when you look at the results, if you just analyze his Soviet policy, he has a lot to argue with just because of the trend of events seemed to be going his way, or went his way at the end of his presidency. Many observers, of course, pointed out the contrast between the Reagan of the first term and the Reagan of the second term. He seemed to take a very hard line in the first term, switched about his tone about 1984, and then we entered what he described himself as a new era, and it was remarkable to see him at the Moscow summit in 88. And when he was asked about his highly publicized references to the evil empire and so on, he just simply replied that that was another time, another era. And he went on to claim during the rest of that year that in fact his basic principles had been vindicated. And so we have this issue of real change in Reagan, but also a claim to consistency. And the subtitle of the paper I want to present was is Change and Consistency. And I consider Reagan a kind of a hardline romantic, but as you'll see, I also have some admiration for some of his qualities as a politician and a statesman. I'm going to read parts of this paper, but it's very deadly to listen to someone read a paper, so I'm going to just summarize parts of it to give you some relief. But the parts I don't want to mess up, I'm going to read to you. The first part of this takes up that period from 1981 through pretty much the end of 1983. When Reagan was following basically a hardline stance in relations to the Soviet Union, but he made some significant modifications. As you all know, presidents often come into power claiming that they're establishing new policies. And historians looking back on this, and political scientists, note that really there are a lot of continuities between the presidents, even in the presidencies that have claimed major change. Robert Osgood put this rather well. He said that the continuities of American foreign policy are always greater than the political claims to innovation would have one believe. To be sure, change has occurred, but much of it is also has a familiar rhythm. Osgood described oscillations in America's world role as one between assertion and retrenchment. And in the post-war years, this change between an assertive foreign policy and a foreign policy of retrenchment on the part of the United States has reflected changes in the Soviet threat. Now, when Reagan came into power, there was a great sense in the country of a Soviet threat. And Reagan responded to this by championing a massive military buildup, and the rhetoric that accompanied that was reminiscent of the old Cold Warriors. And books appeared talking about a new Cold War or revival of the Cold War. Reagan had projected the vision during his election campaign that America would stand tall and turn back the rising Soviet threat. He reaffirmed the doctrine of linkage in dealing with Moscow, indicating that any progress on arms control should be tied to moderation of Soviet imperialism in the Third World. In an early interview with Walter Cronkite, as president, the new president, it was in March of 1981, he cited Soviet aggression in Afghanistan, subversion in Central America, so the intervention by Soviet surrogates, the Cubans in Angola, East Germans in Ethiopia, and on and on. He explained that he was going to rearm the United States, and one of the purposes of this was to strengthen its bargaining positions in arms control. He was still interested in arms control, but he explained that you need to bargain from strength, and that became one of the leading themes of the Reagan administration. And he claimed at the end that he was clearly vindicated on that. In the early stages, he wanted to delay arms control negotiations until the buildup had put in place. And this was the first aspect of the Reagan presidency to be revised. It was the first sign of significant moderation. In that same year, he adopted Carter's dual-track strategy of negotiating on arms control in Europe while continuing to carry out plans for deploying new weapons. Those would be the Pershing II and the cruise launch missiles. Speaking to the National Press Club, I think that was November of 81, he announced his very famous zero option, calling for the elimination of intermediate range missiles, and that, of course, was destined to become the centerpiece of his claim to foreign policy achievement. Now, when this speech was made, and this is one of the controversies over Reagan, when this speech was made, it was conceived, in the view of many people, as essentially a propaganda ploy, not a serious proposal. It was put forward as a proposal that it was assumed the Russians would reject. And it was really seized as an opportunity by Reagan because he knew it would make a good speech and because it would be an effective riposte to Soviet propaganda in Western Europe. The Reagan administration got into a great deal of trouble early in 81. They really helped ignite the nuclear freeze and the peace movement in both Europe and the United States. They made some ill-advised remarks, both Reagan and Haig. Haig talked in terms of kind of a nuclear demonstration, sort of a warning shot across the bow, and that alarmed many Europeans. And Reagan, in a rambling discourse, made some unfortunate remarks about how the United States might cope in limiting a nuclear exchange, and implying that maybe he thought that nuclear war was feasible. So in responding to this, the zero option was put forward, and it proved initially to be remarkably effective. Now, much of the early propaganda benefit was short-lived because Reagan continued to hew a very hard line in his rhetoric with the Soviets, but at least he launched the zero option proposal in the same speech. He called for the opening of the START talks, the strategic arms reduction talks. He had always been critical of the arms control of the 1970s, saying that was allowing a buildup. What he wanted was reductions. And he positioned himself skillfully in that respect. But he hewed to a very hard line nevertheless, and it was in 1983 that he made that famous speech in which he said that the Soviets are the focus of evil in the modern world. Now, it was in possibly the end of 1983. If you were prescient, you could see it coming. Clearly, by 1984, the change occurred, and there was a definite change of tone in the speeches that he gave beginning in January of 1984. Obviously, an election year, he was sensitive to the criticism he had been getting on his hardline stance and the delay in arms control negotiations, the lack of progress, the fact that there hadn't been a summit conference, and so on. And looking back, if you look back to 1980, Reagan had trailed Jimmy Carter only on the question of peace, fear of war, and arms control. That was the only issue on which there was any vulnerability at all to competition with the Democrats. So Reagan, possibly for that, possibly for other reasons, adjusted his position. He was really coming back into line, I think, coping with one of the real realities of the pattern of American opinion. The American public, since the end of World War II, has mixed its anti-Soviet animosity with a really a deep longing for reassuring signs that peace is going to be maintained. And Reagan had to find a position that would enable him to continue with a military buildup and a firm line toward the Soviets, but one that would reassure both European opinion and American opinion that he was effectively going to maintain the peace. And thus we got that a very important speech if you are looking for an articulation of Reagan's policy in his second term. It occurred in the first term, but really set the tone for the second term, where he talked about three guiding principles: realism, strength, and dialogue. Now, in dealing with this issue of change and consistency, I want to mention that there, while this reflected a deep change, one of the remarkable things about Reagan, when you look back over 8 years, is that he positioned himself very shrewdly in ways that allowed him to maneuver, to take advantage of changing circumstances. When he launched his call for a military buildup and the need for strength, he was careful to mention, if you go back and read his speeches, he's careful to mention the importance of negotiation. And even in his inaugural address, he said that in regard to peace, he said, we'll negotiate for it, sacrifice for it, and so on. And in that interview with Cronkite, he made it clear that he wasn't ruling out any kind of summit meeting with Brezhnev. That was a false implication of his stand, and that he was interested in negotiation. One of the things, another thing that's remarkable about Reagan, and I'll say more about his skillful positioning a little later, is that and I think he will be famous for what I would call nostrums. Reagan embraced nostrums and made them politically viable. The quintessential nostrum is supply-side economics, I think. He was going to balance the budget in 4 years by having a military buildup and a tax cut. It's the kind of policy that his competitor in 1980 called voodoo economics, now President Bush. It led to, as was predicted it would happen, massive federal deficits. But it also proved to be politically viable. It's good politics. And Bush had to come around to that as the reality in domestic politics, and that's why when he campaigned, he kept saying, read my lips, no new taxes. Taxes became kind of the T word that you wouldn't talk about in politics. Now, the nostrum in foreign policy was the Strategic Defense Initiative, with which some physicists rail about as being technologically impossible, ridiculous, counterproductive, destabilizing. But Reagan made it viable policy. And it's very interesting to analyze the way in which this could be done. It was appealing because it seemed to put him on the side of doing something about nuclear arms. He expressed a great concern about that. He was going to render nuclear weapons impotent and obsolete. It appealed to Americans who like technological solutions to serious and complicated problems. For those who question the vision of a kind of Astrodome kind of protection, people said, well, maybe it might be feasible for protecting land-based missiles and protect us against a first strike, so it might even have some military utility. For those people that complained about the expense of this, Reagan would just shrug and say, well, it's just kind of it's a research program now. We'll see if it worked. All the problems of destabilizing, escalating costs, and so on would be shoved on to successive administrations. It wasn't going to disrupt the politics of his own terms as president. And finally, you can make a cogent argument, I think, that it put pressure on the Soviets. They genuinely feared this SDI program. And some even claimed, Lloyd Jensen's claimed, that it was a major factor in bringing the Soviet Union back to the negotiating table. So while I think at times his penchant for Nostrum seems like a flaw, he did it in a way that was politically viable. Another trait of Reagan that was an enormous asset was his optimism. I think that's one reason he would embrace Nostrums. He just figured there was going to be a happy ending to these things. People would talk about complications, but he had this abiding faith that it would turn out all right. I guess you have to combine that with the luck of the Irish. Basically, it did turn out all right, contrary to many predictions. But it isn't just a matter of luck. If I have time, I'll say something about this, the theme that the critics who in seeing that things went very well for Reagan in his second term, they tend to dismiss it as luck. It was just fortuitous. It had nothing to do with his policies, or little to do with his policies. Before I get to that, I wanted to make a couple of remarks about his skillful positioning, because Reagan, really, when you analyze his policy with the Soviets, found himself in a position where he could maneuver in either direction no matter what happened. When the Soviets were when negotiations didn't go well in arms control, for example, when he deployed the Pershing II and cruise missiles, the Soviets walked out of the negotiation. He simply said, well, the negotiations are failing because the Soviets won't negotiate. They walked out. We're willing to negotiate. They won't negotiate. If they stayed and negotiate, he would just hew to his hard line and talk about the need for cuts. This didn't really change until his need to change this didn't come until the advent of Gorbachev. Another thing about Reagan, I think it's a very important aspect about Reagan, is that his actions didn't really match his rhetoric, and that is one of the things that enabled him to succeed. In some respects, his policies were even softer than those of his predecessor. He fulfilled his campaign promise to dismantle Carter's grain embargo that had been instituted after the invasion of Afghanistan. His so-called sanctions against the Polish government for cracking down on Solidarity they weren't very onerous. They were very mild, carefully measured. His response to the Korean airline being shot down by the Soviet Union was essentially rhetorical. Minimal sanctions were instituted. He resorted to relatively strong measures to block the building of the Siberian pipeline to Europe, but he backed off from that after he got into trouble with Western Europe. He denounced the SALT, had denounced the SALT II treaty as fatally flawed, but he maintained its provisions throughout the first term, and in the second term only made it allowed a token violation of the SALT II treaty. He was a man who didn't really carry through on his rhetoric. There's more examples of that, but time is pressing and I want to move on to some other points. After the Gorbachev came on the scene and made far-reaching concessions, the negotiations followed a kind of zigzag path, and Reagan did show some flexibility even there, talking about modifying the zero option with a kind of interim approach that would allow temporarily the retention of some missiles. But he even then indicated he was in favor of eliminating them. And eventually, they were able to sign the INF Treaty at the Washington Summit in December of 1987, and it was ratified in time for the Moscow Summit in the spring of 1988. So by then, Reagan had transformed his record on the so-called peace issues. He had held more summits than any other president. He had the first treaty that actually eliminated a class of weapons. He was, by the summer of 1988, on a roll, and he was able to claim this as the substantive proof of his that his principles were vindicated. Well, I'm just going to skip over the luck passage. Believe me, he was lucky. Maybe we can take it up in the question and answer period. It's a passage I want to read. To come to the nub of this paper, which is Reagan's legacy. A journalistic cliche that emerged after the summit was that Reagan had virtually institutionalized top-level meetings of Soviet and U.S. leaders by making them seem normal and almost routine. Actually, Reagan's achievement went well beyond this. He developed a political position that enabled him to negotiate with the Soviets without opening himself to the kind of damaging criticism that disrupted the detente policy of Nixon, Ford, and Kissinger. What I've tried to do this is put this in the context of the diplomacy of the last 20 years. The detente of the early and mid-1970s was vulnerable to criticism on four points. First, that it was oversold. Nixon and Kissinger taken a thrashing on this point of raising expectations too high on detente. Number two, that it slighted key American values such as human rights. Carter was able to beat up on Ford and Kissinger and Nixon on this issue. You might remember that when Solzhenitsyn wasn't invited to the White House and Carter came out in his campaign with a very strong theme about human rights and embraced human rights in American foreign policy. Three, that it seemed to reflect U.S. decline. And four, that it did not restrain Soviet expansionism in the Third World. Reagan's handling of Soviet-American relations, despite all its shortcomings, effectively protected his negotiations and agreements from all these criticisms. First, by making his suspicion of the Soviet system axiomatic, he was always well positioned to explain any subsequent intensification of Soviet-American antagonism or Soviet act of bad faith. Furthermore, while some of his judgments about Gorbachev struck critics, especially on his right wing, as alarmingly naive, this is in an earlier part of the paper, it's nice to be immortal. Gorbachev, when Reagan was asked about his early speeches, when he said that Soviet leaders embraced the moral principle of lying, cheating, and so on in promoting world communism, he said, well, Gorbachev's a Soviet leader. What about your statement that they lie, they don't hesitate to lie, cheat, and so on? And he said, well, Gorbachev is different. And the hardline right wing had a fit about this, saying that he's naive, that Gorbachev came up to the through the ranks, as Margaret Thatcher says, he has iron teeth and so on. And it sounded alarmingly naive. But his comments, I think Gorbachev is different, but his comments only focused on Gorbachev and implied no support for the Soviet system. Nor could Reagan's simplistic but not entirely inaccurate statement that Mikhail Gorbachev was different outweigh a long career of Soviet bashing. Indeed, Reagan's apparent revival or intensification of the Cold War during his first term established such low expectations for relations with the Soviets that when an improvement did finally occur, he appeared to have delivered more than was generally expected. Reagan's credentials as a Cold Warrior also protected him from charges of naivete, except from his right wing. Furthermore, his administration continued to stress the importance of readiness and vigilance. And if you look back through the speeches, that was a prominent theme. One aspect of this was a coordinated emphasis on candor. Thus, on his visit to the Soviet Union in August 1988, Frank Carlucci, who was National Security Advisor and then became Secretary of Defense, asserted that the Soviets remained in an offensive military posture in spite of their highly publicized announcements that they were adopting a defensive strategy. And you'll note that in the Bush administration, they've continued the same line. Reagan was even more careful to avoid any appearance of slighting human rights in his pursuit of agreements with the Soviets. Clearly, his administration had not neglected the lesson of recent American political history. In 1974, Senator Henry Jackson won a sensational legislative victory on this issue when the Senate considered a Soviet-American trade agreement. He secured the Senate's approval of an amendment making most favored nation treatment contingent on the liberalization of Jewish immigration. Subsequently, as I mentioned a moment ago, Jimmy Carter scored major blows by developing the theme of human rights. So potent was this issue in the mid-70s that it was really the centerpiece of Carter's foreign policy. Although Reagan criticized, at least rhetorically, although Reagan criticized Carter's human rights policies for their alleged weakening of American allies, he adopted the Jean Kirkpatrick view, he did not hesitate to denounce Soviet oppression. Indeed, to make himself impregnable on this issue while en route to the Moscow summit, he spoke forcefully about human rights during a stopover in Helsinki. Furthermore, while in Moscow, he deliberately dramatized the point that negotiating with the Kremlin did not mean a retreat on human rights. Risking the displeasure of his hosts, he made remarkably frank public statements, and even more notably, held highly publicized meetings with Russian dissidents and religious leaders. Fortunately for Reagan, Gorbachev's reactions were far milder than the abuse that his predecessors heaped upon Carter for making similar gestures. Reagan wasn't perfect on that, and that's a sign that it was a well-thought-out policy in his administration. You'll recall that when he was in Moscow, he did attribute the restraint on Jewish immigration from Russia to a bureaucratic bungle. It was certainly more than a bureaucratic bungle. But by and large, he was very effective in making the point that he was keeping human rights prominently on the agenda. At home, the reactions of the public also lacked the negative undertones that surfaced during Carter's presidency. Reagan's theme in negotiating from strength effectively countered the earlier tendency to associate detente with U.S. decline. A Washington Post poll taken shortly after the Moscow summit indicated that Reagan got more credit for boosting America's morale than for American economic prosperity. His theme of standing tall proved to be enormously popular. Moreover, despite continuing scandals of waste, fraud, and abuse in the Pentagon, Far more Americans thought that the United States became militarily stronger under Reagan than said it became weaker. The Washington Post survey also suggested that U.S. Influence in the world had increased, that, I'm sorry, 41% said U.S. influence in the world had increased, in contrast to only 24% who thought it had declined. There's a section in here talking about Paul Kennedy's books and the whole solvency school, that we actually spend ourselves into weakness by spending so much on the military. And that idea has certainly percolated through the establishment to some extent. But in the public at large, Reagan was successful in maintaining a consensus in support of what he was doing. Hardliners maintain the view that although the Soviet Union and its clients were in retreat from various third world countries, they maintain the view that we had to maintain an assertive and strong U.S. foreign policy and a military buildup and so on. And they said that the vindication of this is the retreat by the Soviets in the third world. The Reagan administration insisted upon making Soviet involvement in the Third World a prominent item on all the Summit Comet conference agendas, at least the Washington and the Moscow summit. Moreover, in the aftermath of the Moscow summit, the president seemed to be having his way. After all, Soviet troops were leaving Afghanistan, the number of Vietnamese troops in Kampuchea was declining, an agreement in principle on a Cuban pullout from Angola was announced. Kremlin was obviously disenchanted with the fruits of its aid to Ethiopia, and on and on. These developments not only marked reversal of the situation during the late 1970s, when the Soviets appeared to be on the march in the Third World, but seemed to vindicate this idea of linkage, Reagan's revival of linkage when he entered the White House, and his stubborn insistence that the Soviets rein in their clients and in their foreign adventures. Whereas the discredited detente of the 1970s appeared to permit, if not invite, Soviet expansion, Reagan's agreements with the Soviets on arms control were linked to Soviet withdrawal. Moreover, the publicity given to the Reagan doctrine in general and the delivery of Stinger missiles to the Afghan rebels in particular reinforced the notion that the new Soviet-American accommodation resulted to a significant extent from U.S. strength and firmness. Thus, by the summer of 1988, Reagan's policy towards the Soviet seemed to be well and truly on a roll. The final point I want to make as we get to the crossroads, the superpowers at the crossroads of this change, if it is in fact a new era, is that when you step away from it and look over a longer historical perspective, you really wonder what historical forces are at work here and where they're going to take us. And if we look back on the whole period of the Cold War, it isn't necessarily something to cheer about that the Cold War may be in the process of being liquidated. It's generally applauded as a positive development, but I have my doubts about that. I think we've lived through a halcyon period. I think that many beneficent effects came from American policy during this period and a policy of extraordinary U.S. leadership. And I think that in the future, with the breakdown of bipolarity and what possibly will be a decline in American leadership in the world, it may not be such a safe and nice place to be. I'm referring to the Earth. I think we really have lived through an extraordinary period, and as you, some of you who may have heard my talk here last time when I talked about the long peace, I think we are living through a long peace, and some of the best decades may have been the ones that the U.S. presided over. Furthermore, I'm not so enamored of the idea that
if Gorbachev succeeds in Russia, that the world is going to be better off. This is no longer a new idea, but when I wrote that piece for the Virginia Quarterly Review, I don't know, six years ago or so, when Reagan was still in his hardline phase, I said, he was talking about the need for capitalism around the world, and he's claimed that he was vindicated in even in the communist world by attempts to put in free market elements into the economies in China and the Soviet Union and so on. As I mentioned then, we might be in real trouble if the Soviet Union developed a dynamic capitalist economy, because it's a very big and populous country, and it would be much tougher to deal with. The Soviets have a very long history of expansionism. I mean, the Russians have a very long history of expansionism, and they could be difficult to deal with. And there are potentially serious dangers in these changes that are afoot, in this whole loosening up in this new era of negotiation. The Soviets have kept the lid on the Balkans. The Balkans, it's no great advantage to have the Balkans return to the status of quarreling, rival nationalisms, potentially setting off wars in southeastern Europe. It could create very dangerous tensions in Europe. The change in Soviet-American relations is going to give German nationalists a real opportunity, and we may see a dangerous revival of German nationalism in Germany. Some people say this is nothing to worry about because the Germans are now so prosperous and they've fundamentally changed. Who knows? Maybe the German role in starting World War I and World War II is a salutary warning of the danger of revival of the German problem. If Russia has develops greater strength in the long run, it could be a serious matter. If they continue to decline in the Balkans. Become once again a kind of a powder keg, that could be a serious problem. So we don't know what the long-term results of this are going to be, but for now it appears that that Ronald Reagan was extraordinarily successful in his policy towards the Soviet Union. This doesn't exonerate him in any way on other aspects of his policy, but in his policy towards the Soviet Union, he may be if you judge it by the results, extraordinarily successful. The issue is, of course, whether or not this was merely a matter of luck, fortuitous factors within the Soviet Union that brought this opening. But Reagan was at least had the flexibility, and he's always had that flexibility to seize opportunities. And in carving out a place for himself in history, he was willing to embrace the idea of negotiating with the Soviet Union. And he did so in a way that maintained a foreign policy consensus in this country, unlike his predecessors. So he may have been lucky, but he is in a position to claim that he was vindicated. And the final piece of Reagan's luck may be that perestroika will fail, but we'll have to wait and see about that. I'll stop with that.
Who'd like to begin our discussion? Wilson Newman.
Professor, if I recall correctly, you mentioned two of Mr. Reagan's cabinet members. Mr. Haig, who was in incumbency, was relatively brief and here in part of the Reagan administration. Mr. Colucci, whose incumbency was relatively brief at the end. I think you've used two terms in describing the action of the government. One, you referred to Mr. Reagan did so-and-so. The other was Reagan Reagan administration did so and so. With that as a backdrop, my question is, would you comment on to what extent the decisions, the speeches, the policy, the implementation and expression resulted from collegial activity, and how much was just native shrewdness from a very varied life, from an actor, a union organizer, a bargainer, and so on.
Well, as I understand it, Reagan would listen to many opinions, and when he was confronted with a decision, it's very difficult to come to grips with. You ask a very tough question because the testimony of insiders is contradictory on this, but. I want to pick up on your point about just from native shrewdness. I think that Reagan, in the process of a long political career, especially if you include the years of the going back into the 60s when he was kind of on the chicken circuit making a lot of political speeches, he did develop an intuition on what would fly with the American people. He did have a real intuition about that. When he listened to advice, to take for example the invasion of Grenada, which was Reagan wanted a victory over communism. He wanted a rollback kind of victory. Grenada was an easy target, a safe one. So it fit his criteria, his kind of innate criteria for not taking really big gambles. He talks big, but not taking big gambles in action. But the commentators on that initially were very skeptical about how people would react. Reagan knew how they would react from the beginning, that would be applauded, that would go over very successfully. And that whole issue was sealed as soon as that student got off the plane and kissed the ground. Reagan's intuition on how the American people will react was often very good. And I think that was built up over many years of experience and just feeling feedback from his speeches. I think he's has a native intuition for maintaining some flexibility in his stances. He's willing to maneuver. If he's told by his aides that a policy is going sour, he's willing in most instances to back off from it. So in that sense, I think he was a kind of chief executive who could function if he got reasonably good staff work. His ability to process policy options in the way that Jimmy Carter did, I just don't think he had that kind of ability. I think it was he was an intuitive kind of thinker, he wouldn't reason things out in ways that you could diagram. I think Carter could diagram a lot of his decisions. On the matter of collegiality, I've had mixed reports on that. One of the most interesting some people say that all the cabinet members the members in a meeting would be listened to. In reading memoirs and the kiss and tell books and so on, you get the sense that we know that different department chiefs were vying with one another. But one tactic for influencing policy was to try to insert a policy into a speech that was written for him and have him read it. That was the way to get at policy. So you have a sense that policy making was not an orderly process in the Reagan administration. Now, there must be a lot of people that have some experience, have heard people talking about this, that could add to that.
We're doing all right. Next question. Bill Wenzel?
I think, following up on that thought, it seems to me several speakers we've had here that are in the administration uniformly express the very highest regard for Reagan in person, even though they might be less than wildly enthusiastic about some of the things that they've done. Bearing out what you said about his instinct, intuition, he commanded enormous respect and loyalty, even though I think he failed in not showing loyalty to his own subordinates.
Well, there again, I think initially, maybe I'm just not deeply enough into this to see the common thread, but the reports seem contradictory. Some of the insiders say that he didn't engender a kind of warm sense of loyalty. He didn't seem to be really interested in the intimate details of your welfare. On the other hand, you're right that he's... often spoken of in terms that are very respectful by people who are very able and good judges of leaders. I would say that there's something, there are flaws in the man, or he wouldn't have, there wouldn't have been so many kiss and tell books about him. If he had really engendered deep loyalty, I don't think we would have seen such a spate of kiss and tell books while he was still in office. So I have some doubts about some of his personal qualities. But as a leader of a people, I think that he had a kind of, I think James Nathan calls it a natural grace. I mean, when he's shot, he can joke with the surgeons. He's very gracious towards the opposition. He was capable of very nice gestures when there were national tragedies. No one could preside at a funeral better than Ronald Reagan. He had that kind of natural grace of leadership. And some of you, I'm sure, heard him speak when he was here at UVA. And I know Norman did. And his ability to make a speech was unparalleled. You kind of denigrate the man to say that he would select foreign policy issues on the basis of whether or not it would make a good speech. But I think there's an element of truth in that. On the other hand, we were chatting about this yesterday, Norman and I, one of the things Jimmy Carter couldn't do was make a good speech. And it was one of the key flaws in his leadership. That's a powerful tool in a democratic society. You've got to be able to do that.
Next for Howard Cromwell.
This may seem like a super silly question, and based maybe a lot on gossip, but there were some writers felt that Reagan's change in attitude towards the Russians was influenced by his wife, who felt that she wanted him to have a place in history, which would be denied if he kept on this hard line of policy. Do you put any weight on that?
Yeah, I think that's true. I don't know. I mean, she's a very important person in his life, and if she embraced that, I mean, he would consider it seriously. But I think he would have done it even if she hadn't been there, or even embraced that period, because what president doesn't want a favorable place in the history textbooks? And that was a high road to achieving that. Gorbachev, this gives me an opportunity to inject that piece of a point about Reagan's luck. while the Soviets were overextending themselves and so on, Reagan railed about Soviet expansionism. Once they were overextended, and Soviet authorities had, if you read the literature, had already pointed this out, that the Soviet Union was shifting gears in 1980 at the same time that Reagan was sounding the alarm that we had to have this big military buildup. They were already going into a period of retrenchment. So the timing was just perfect. Then he puts his policy into place, military buildup and so on. The Soviets retrench, and Reagan claims credit for the retrenchment. They're in a deep economic crisis. We have the advent of Gorbachev, and Reagan's had time to have his military buildup in place. The Soviets are now really clearly shifting gears, probably largely for internal reasons, and Reagan can say, well, there you have it, bargaining from strength. And it just worked perfectly. Even his policy of patience is ideal, because with a guy as dynamic as Gorbachev and tuned into public relations and so on, all you have to do, and someone who has an economic crisis of the magnitude of the Soviet crisis, all you have to do is wait. Gorbachev puts something on the table, and if you don't agree with it in 2 weeks, he says, well, if you don't want that, how about this? So patience works beautifully. So his policy has had the ideal partner, and everything fell into place for him that way.
Next question, Arthur Stalker.
Why do you suppose linkage was not exerted in the area of maximum concern to America, that is Soviet influence in this continent, Central America, and in Cuba?
Uh-huh.
Is there some impediment that made it impracticable to do that? Certainly the withdrawal from Afghanistan and Angola. Uh-huh. It's nowhere nearly as significant to us as a
That's right.
In this
hemisphere. That's a wonderful question, and I've wondered about that myself. I think one reason may be that it's harder to make linkage work in Central America because it's such an ace for the Soviets. You come across references to making it work. But the Soviets can cause so much aggravation so cheaply there that, and I think they're very reluctant to give up on that leverage as long as we're hurting them in Afghanistan. You know, even with the agreement in Afghanistan, by continuing the supply to the rebels, and they're continuing to pressure the Kabul regime, it hurts the Soviets. That's a humiliation for them, the fall of the Kabul regime. But that's just a guess. I think it's because they can't make it work. They can't invade down there because of the vestiges of the Vietnam syndrome, and because it would probably be stupid to do it anyway. I hope that's the reason why they didn't do it. But your guess is as good as mine. Why do you think that?
Well, I think your answer is probably the one that I would adopt, that it is to the Soviets very important to retain that as a bargaining tool against us.
Yeah, right.
Just as we like to have tools against them in Europe, they like to have tools against us here. And that's one of the last things they would give up.
Yeah. I'm sure it's been raised as a matter of linkage, but of course we haven't insisted on it.
Yes.
But they've applied linkage in a kind of a flexible way. They kind of put it on the agenda and say it's there, but they don't have hard and fast demands. Certainly nothing was going to hold up that INF treaty.
Wilford Gresham.
You made the point about how if Gorbachev's reforms work, we might find ourselves in a hot spot. The curious thing is, I read at least a year ago in a British journal, the International Affairs, Chatham House, exactly the same thing said about China. That really, we were being a bit naive in pushing Deng's reforms,
mm-hmm.
and because if China reforms where, she'll be a threat to us. Is that true?
Well,
I'm talking about both things, and we are on the wrong track. You're trying to put capitalism into both Russia and China.
I think so, really, on balance. The thing is that study of history doesn't enable you to make any predictions with certainty, because every historical situation is unique, but it does raise warning flags. And when other power centers grow up, they're potentially threatening. They could be benign. You don't know. There may be generations of quiescence. I mean, when Bismarck united Germany in the 1860s, there was a long period when Bismarck was in control of German foreign policy, and his assumption was that Germany was satiated. There was going to be big trouble in Europe if Germany tried to expand further. And he reined the Germans in, but after he was dismissed from power in 1890, the Germans became more assertive, and it was destabilizing. It could not have been destabilizing if the Germans didn't have that power. So if the Chinese and the Soviets develop more power, there's the potential there that they'll be destabilizing. And if you look at the history of Russia, it's not very reassuring. I mean, if they have power, they'll expand. But it may be that they can adopt elements of capitalism, but because of the assertion of nationalism within the country, there will be a corresponding source of weakness, and there would it would be balanced out. But who can say?
In other words, you don't think that we are on the wrong track in promoting democracy and capitalism in China and Russia?
Well, your initial question, I think, was capitalism.
Yeah.
I think that I would say that it worries me in the long run. I think that capitalism is a better system than communism, and I just assume that they be weak, and if they're weak, that suits me. So to the extent that capitalism promotes strength, it's going to be a potential source of worry.
Bill Harmsley.
You seem to overlook it's all based on the assumption that there's never going to be any change in human behavior, and that people are not studying the world situation, studying societies where there is, for example, I'm sure that the Russians have taken into consideration the development in the U.S. Dobrynin was here for 25 years, dean of the diplomatic corps, advisor to Gorbachev. Gorbachev is of a new generation. Mm-hmm. They grew up under a different situation, certainly different from their predecessors. Example is one of Gorbachev's colleagues was a communist from Czechoslovakia. They were roommates at Moscow University. That roommate is now a dissident. Zdeněk Mináš is a dissident teaching at the University of Vienna. So that there is an element of hope in all this, that people are striving for an improvement in society, and it's simply not a political antagonism or a political battle. I think that Reagan benefited by the forces that were being generated for change within, that were exclusive of what our position was on our relations. And the fact that Reagan started out with the hard line did not discourage Gorbachev, because this is what he expected, because this is the way, this was the reaction to former Soviet posture, so that he was able to change without any problem, because there was a receptive group on the other end of this thing. So I think that we overlook the human element, and we're just thinking of the political situation, the economic situation, rather than that humanity is involved in this.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but it's you know, it's a political process, and I definitely agree with you that Reagan is the perfect partner for Gorbachev, and Gorbachev for Reagan. And what Reagan did in his first term vindicates Gorbachev's arguments that Brezhnev's policies just, it provoked a U.S. buildup, it led to overextension, the economy was stagnant and all that sort of thing. So, there is a new wind blowing in the Soviet Union. I mean, I did mention in my talk that Gorbachev is different. I think he is different from other previous Russian leaders.
He's been different in Eastern Europe all along.
Yeah.
Even when the communists took over Czechoslovakia, I was a fellow there for a year, and I certainly was able to operate both with the communist element. They get great respect because their ideas of achievement were something that we had without being a capitalist country.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and within the Soviet Union, if you spend any time there, I spent 5 years one-on-one traveling with people, staying on their farms, because there were no other places. They're just like we are.
Mm-hmm.
We had discussions that were just like I would be talking to one of my colleagues at the university and so on. So I don't think that, I think we overlook the human element in all our analyses. I think that that there is a great hope for change, and I think it's coming.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that what you're calling the human element, though, could restrain a return to Soviet expansionism? Or?
Oh, I would think so. I would think so, because if it penetrates the ruling class, certainly there's going to be some effect, some influence on the general policy and foreign relations.
Two final questions. Professor Fernbach at his hand. First, you asked Louise a short question, and then last question, Professor Graydon.
What do you think of Reagan's attitude toward the United Nations and the World Court?
I'm no student of that. He was quite friendly towards the UN at the end of his term, made a nice speech. The matter of the World Court condemned us for the policy of our shenanigans in waters around Nicaragua, mining harbors and so on, and he thumbed his nose at the World Court. My own view is that made for terrible public relations, but is only a foreign policy.
You don't have to answer everything, because Rich Williamson, who is Assistant Secretary for International Organization Affairs, is going to be here on the 14th of September, and we can ask him.
I'll let him answer it.
Finally, Norman Graydon.
It seems to me that your general presentation, as well as your answer to questions, suggests that in general you're following the pattern of Donald Regan, who says that the members of the right, of the Republican Party, who thought that Reagan was their man, were always wrong. That Reagan was always a liar. And I think in his early administration, it was the members of the right who commanded most attention, people like Richard Allen, as well as Fred Eakley and Richard Pearl. But it certainly was never a monolithic administration. You know, there's simply too many people in any administration, have them all think the same way. And that Reagan, therefore, as he moved forward, as you suggest, towards a accommodation with Russia, was moving in ways that did not at all depart from his own convictions. But I think that still leaves unanswered The basic question is to whether Reagan, as he moved in a new direction, was his own man, cultivating his own thoughts, or whether it was still a hands-off presidency in which others were able to sort of gain his attention, and moderates gained his attention, including his own wife, Deaver, and others, and gradually pushed the right out and gained control of his mind and his policy because they convinced him that there was greater political and diplomatic mileage. So I don't think you answered that question completely. You seem really to take the suggestion that it was Reagan was his own man, rather than being, as Mr. Newman suggested, part of a group pushing him in a direction led perhaps by all, by Schultz as much as anyone else.
Well, a man as ill-informed about details as Reagan has to be part of a group, part of an administration to succeed. I mean, he just has to have a good staff around him or he's out of it. That's the reality of the Reagan presidency. But on some things he cares deeply. Within a narrow range, he's an activist. And within a narrow range, he wants to preside over events. That's one thing about Reagan, is he maneuvers into a position where he is presiding in the limelight. And he made it clear on certain issues that he wanted certain things, and forceful people in his administration had to accept that. When he decided he wanted INF, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, he was going to get that treaty, and he was in charge on that issue, I think. So on some issues, he was really in charge, and there, it's definitely true that he was not understood by the right wing. And one of the passages I think I skipped over in the interest of time, he made a responding to critics of the INF treaty from the right wing, he said that some of the people who are objecting the most and just refusing even to accede to the idea of ever getting any understanding, whether they realize it or not, those people basically down in their deepest thoughts have accepted that war is inevitable. And this was not a new idea for Reagan. During the first year of his administration, he asserted, "I have always recognized that ultimately there's got to be a settlement, a solution." He always had in mind that we had to get together with the Soviets eventually. The other way, if you don't believe that, then you're going to find yourself trapped in the back of your mind. The inevitability of conflict is going to end the world. This remark suggests a long-perceived difference, fundamental difference, that he saw between himself and his hardline supporters, and he articulated it in the first year of his administration, and it cropped up at the end of administration. So, in that sense, I mean, I wouldn't want to put myself in Don Regan's camp generally, but on that issue, I agree with him.
Well, we're awfully pleased that in 1989, Sterling Koenig has come back to the center. 1990 isn't that far away, and we hope he'll be back then. We have a continuing tie with him. Thank you very much.